Welcome everyone to the Sutta class. So I didn't expect so many people, so just very quickly printing out some more copies. If you haven't got a copy, we've printed out now, please, if you can share, if at all possible. So at least everyone got access to a sheet, even if it's only the one sitting next to you. I can lend you one more sheet here, if anyone wants one. Yeah, right. Anyone want another sheet? Okay, I'll use it then. You can actually have a look for this. Because today, instead of reading from the Majjhima Nikaya, I've got a couple of suttas here from the Sangyutta Nikaya. And because many of you haven't got those books available, so I decided to photocopy the relevant pages out, which is why that we have them here. Okay. You okay? So here we go. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. All the sheets you have here, and we have it, which I photocopied here, it starts off on the page 1327, should be quite clear there. The reason I put that one on there is because you had basically, making sure I didn't waste any paper, you had most of two pages which was free. Because I really wanted to start at Sutta number 68, the Kosambi Sutta, then follow with the Susima Sutta, which is number 70. And I decided to put this one in here, this sutta, what's called number 8 from the Chittasangyutta, just as a little filler, but it's also an entertaining filler. Just to show that in Buddhism we do have a sense of humour. And even though this sense of humour was at the expense of the Jains, which were like the competitors in the time of the Buddha to Buddhism, it's still a very funny little sutta. But also, it does actually make a point about meditation. So this is from the Chitta Sangyutta. And as it happened, when this publication was first presented, and I first looked at it, I just opened up the book at random, and this was the first sutta I read in the new translation. So this is one of my favourite ones from the translation. I'll read it out first of all. We can comment on it afterwards, because it's such a short sutta. Now on that occasion, Nigantha Nataputta, who was actually the leader of the Jains, who later became known as Mahavira, those two were contemporaries. It's fascinating. At the same time, in the same place, we had the leaders of two world religions living side by side. Now on that occasion, Nigantha Nataputta had arrived at Machikasanda, which is a town, together with a large retinue of Nigantas, Jains. Chitta, the householder, heard about this, and together with a large number of lay followers, approached Nigantha Nataputta. Obviously that Chitta had his own retinue of people. He exchanged greetings with Nigantha Nataputta, and when they had concluded their greetings and cordial talk, sat down at one side, which is a mark of respect. Nigantha Nataputta then said to him, householder, referring to Chitta, do you have faith in the ascetic Gotama when he says there is a concentration, a samadhi, without thought and examination? This is vitakka and vichara. There is a cessation of such thought and examination. And Chitta replies, in this matter, venerable sir, I do not go by faith in the Blessed One when he says there is a samadhi without vitakka vichara, without thought and examination. There is a cessation of thought and examination. When this was said, Nigantha Nataputta looked up proudly towards his own retinue and said, see this, sirs, how straightforward is this Chitta, the householder, how honest and open. One who thinks that thought and examination can be stopped might imagine he could catch the wind in a net or arrest the current of the river Ganges with his own fist. What do you think, venerable sir? Replied Chitta. What do you think, venerable sir, replied Chitta to Nigantha Nataputta, which is superior, knowledge or faith? A knowledge, householder, is superior to faith. Well, venerable sir, says Chitta, to whatever extent I wish, secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, I enter and dwell in the first jhana, which is accompanied by thought and examination, with rapture and happiness born of seclusion. Then, to whatever extent I wish, with the subsiding of thought and examination, I enter and dwell in the second jhana. Then, to whatever extent I wish, with the fading away as well of rapture, I enter and dwell in the third jhana. Then, to whatever extent I wish, with the abandoning of pleasure and pain, I enter and dwell in the fourth jhana. Since I know and see thus, venerable sir, in what other ascetic or Brahmin need I place faith regarding the claim that there is a concentration without thought and examination, a cessation of thought and examination? In other words, when he first said, he said, I don't believe the Buddha. And so Nigantanatha Buddha said, see, even his Buddhist disciples don't believe in such rubbish. And then he says, I don't believe in it because I know it. When this was said, Nigantanatha Buddha looked askance at his own retinue and said, see this, sirs, how crooked is this chitta, the householder. How fraudulent and deceptive. Just now, venerable sir, we understood you to say, see this, sirs, how straightforward is this chitta, the householder. How honest and open. Yet now we understand you to say, see this, sirs, how crooked is this chitta, the householder. How fraudulent and deceptive. If your former statement is true, venerable sir, then your latter statement is false. Or if your former statement is false, then your latter statement is true. And further, venerable sir, said Tachitta, these 10 reasonable questions come up. When you understand their meaning, then you might respond to me along with your retinue. And no one actually really understands what these questions were, but that's by the way. And then Chitta the householder rose from his seat and departed without having asked Nigantanatha Buddha these 10 reasonable questions. So there was one of the Buddhist monks, not Buddhist monks, the Buddhist lay supporters, confounding and bamboozling Nigantanatha Buddha, the leader of the Jains. Now, one of the interesting things there is actually to see that what we mean about the thought and examination with Vitakka Vichara, this is a thing which is finished off in the second jhana. There's many of you who know my teachings and maybe have experienced these things for yourself. Thought and examination actually stops a long time even before you enter the jhanas, which is why this Vitakka Vichara doesn't mean just the ordinary type of thinking. As I explained in my books on jhanas, this is just the last movement of the mind. And it was interesting, and I make a good point of this, this was obviously way beyond the knowledge and experience of the Jains, that they had such, ignorance that such a thing was possible, that he compared such an achievement of second jhana to stopping the mind, as if it was like trying to catch the wind in a net or arrest the current of the river Ganges. And I've used that quote many times, actually, to make what is actually quite a controversial statement, which is a statement which I think has some merit to it, that it was the Buddha who discovered the jhanas in that age, that no one else was doing them beforehand. Certainly, Nigantanatha Buddha didn't even believe there was a possibility of a second jhana. It was all rubbish. So, certainly he had no experience or knowledge of the possibility of such an attainment. Any questions about that so far? Or I should actually make another little point before I ask the questions. Some of our monks have been doing some research on these suttas have their parallels in other traditions, in the Chinese tradition. This is a common heritage to all Buddhists, these are suttas, but we have here the translations from the Pali. And this few monks have been managing to get translation from the Chinese and to see whether those translations have any difference from the translations we have now. And one of the things which was found, that in the Chinese they did have a different word for this vitakka vichara, this thought and examination, when it's used in the ordinary context of, you know, contemplation, thinking, and when we use it in the contents of jhana. The Chinese translator uses a completely different word for the two. emphasizing what I've been saying, what other meditating monks have been saying, that those two words, thought and examination, as it's translated here, do have different meanings. In the case of the jhanas, thought and examination is not the appropriate word. It has just a movement of the mind onto that object, and the mind holding onto that object, as those of you who have heard me talk about jhanas have heard me describe many times. So anyway, has anyone got any questions about that sutta? No? Going, gone. Okay, now we go to Sutta 68. Was one of the main reasons I wanted to bring these suttas up from the Sanyutta Nikaya. And this is very interesting because on this occasion they give a simile which actually tells you the difference between the stream winner and the enlightened one, the fully enlightened arahat. Because many times that people have a need to actually explore more deeply what is the fundamental difference between a stream winner, one who's seen the Dhamma, and the arahat, one who's actually realized the Dhamma. And sometimes it's a bit confusing. Well, if you're a stream winner, you've seen the Dhamma, doesn't that make you enlightened? Why do you have to go further to become an arahat, a fully enlightened person? And it's in this sutta here, 68, that they give a wonderful metaphor, which is well worth bringing to your attention, which is the difference, or one way of seeing the difference between the stream winner and the fully enlightened arahat. And it's called the Kosambi Sutta. On one occasion, the Venerable Musila, the Venerable Sawita, who don't appear anywhere else except in the sutta, and the Venerable Narada and the Venerable Ananda were living at Kosambi in Gosita's park. Then the Venerable Sawita said to the Venerable Musila, "Friend Musila, apart from faith, apart from personal preference, apart from oral tradition, apart from reasoned reflection, apart from acceptance of a view after pondering it, does the Venerable Musila have personal knowledge thus, with birth as a condition, aging and death comes to be?" This is one of the stages of the what's called dependent origination. And it's actually the Nidana Sanyutta, which is a series of suttas in which this occurs, is all about the 12 links of dependent origination. And he answers, "Friend Sawita, apart from faith, apart from personal preference, apart from oral tradition, apart from reason reflection, apart from acceptance of a view after pondering, I know this, I see this, with birth as a condition, aging and death comes to be. Friend Musila, apart from faith, apart from personal preference, apart from oral tradition, apart from reason reflection, apart from acceptance and view after pondering it, have you personal knowledge thus, with existence as a condition, there comes birth?" And he says, "Yes, apart from personal preference, apart from oral tradition, apart from reason reflection, apart from acceptance of view after pondering it, I know this, I see this, with existence as a condition comes birth." And so with all the other links of dependent origination, which is in all, which I haven't got down here now, is with ignorance as a condition comes the volitional formations, from the volitional formations comes consciousness, from the consciousness, especially here meaning the rebirth consciousness and the consciousnesses which come after that, come name and form. From name and form come the six sense bases. From six sense bases comes contact. From contact comes feeling. From feeling comes craving. From craving comes upadana, usually said attachment, but very often meaning fuel. And then from fuel comes existence. From existence comes birth, from birth comes old age, suffering and death, as here. And so he gets finally, "Friend Musila, apart from faith, apart from personal preference, apart from oral tradition, apart from reason reflection, apart from acceptance of a view after pondering it, Does the Venerable Musila have personal knowledge thus, with ignorance as a condition? I usually say delusion rather than ignorance. Comes a cessation of the volitional formations, the karma formations. And he said, friend, so it, apart from faith, apart from personal preference, apart from oral tradition, apart from reason and reflection, apart from acceptance of a view after pondering it, I know this, I see this. With ignorance as a condition comes the volitional formations, the karma formations. And then he goes off in reverse about, do you actually know this just from faith? You just believe this stuff? Or is it just preference? You'd like to believe in this? Is it your tradition which you follow? Is it because you've reasoned this out? Is it because you accept that view after pondering it? Is it because of this you know the cessation of these conditions, which is that when ignorance ceases, volitional formation ceases, when volitional formation ceases, rebirth consciousness ceases, rebirth consciousness ceases, means the nama rupa, the objects of consciousness cease. When the nama rupa ceases, then the six senses cease. The six senses cease means contact ceases. Contact ceases means feeling ceases. Feeling ceases means craving ceasing. Craving ceasing means upadana, attachment, if you like, ceasing. From that ceasing, existence ceases. Because existence ceases, birth ceases. Because birth ceases, that's the end of old age, sickness and death. Standard formulation of dependent origination in its cessation mode. And all the time, Venerable Sila is saying he has personal knowledge of, so he has a personal knowledge of these things. In other words, it's not just from faith or through reasoning. And then he continues, Venerable Sila, apart from faith, apart from personal preferences, apart from oral tradition, apart from reason and reflection, apart from acceptance of a view after pondering it, does the Venerable Musila have personal knowledge thus? Nibbana is the cessation of existence. Friend Sarvita, apart from faith, apart from personal preference, apart from oral tradition, apart from reason and reflection, apart from acceptance of a view after pondering it, I know this, I see this. Nibbana is the cessation of existence. Then the Venerable Musila is an arahat, one whose taints are destroyed. When this was said, the Venerable Musila kept silent. It's going to be told later that he wasn't an arahat, but he could know and see this. Before I go further, are there any questions so far on Musila's answers? Is this too deep for you? You all heard the dependent origination before? Basically, I'll just go through it in a very quick explanation. From the delusion, especially the delusion of a sense of self and the seeking for happiness somewhere else other than here, we make karma by body, speech and mind. That's the volitional formations. The Buddha often said that karma is equivalent to intention. It's what we intend to do. That's called our karma. And we very often we act, we speak, we even think out of delusion, what we want in the world. He says that creates sort of the grounding of consciousness for the future, especially in our future birth. And once that consciousness arises, automatically we have the accompaniments of consciousness. We have to have the objects of consciousness, which also include the six senses and the feeling, the whole sensory apparatus. He says, from that, especially with ignorance in the background, what we feel we have craving for. And that craving is literally the fuel for the future. And that future creates future existence, and with it birth. And from birth we get old age, suffering and death. This is the dependent origination. To put it another way, to actually to combine these factors, is because of delusion. And not only do we make karma formations, but that's equivalent to craving. We want, we intend. And that wanting, that intending, it creates the fuel for our future birth. Whatever you want, they have the karma behind it, the intention, you create those future realms for your state, for yourself. And there you get born, have to go through this whole process again and again and again. Yes. Yes.
The asavas, this is a word, another very important Pali word, means the outflowings of the mind. To understand what it means, you can understand yourself sitting here. And why can't you stay at home inside of yourself? Why do you always go out into the world, seeking either a sensory distraction, excitement, fulfillment, seeking out the future or the past? You can understand the asavas, the outflowings of the mind, very easily when you try and sit in meditation. Why can't you just let go and sit in the moment and be inside this moment? Why do you always have to think, which is always somewhere else, driving the mind outside of this moment, outside of this place? You can actually see very clearly these asavas, especially when you try and be still. That's when you notice them very clearly. That's the asavas. And you can see how these are driven by delusion. Thinking that if, for example, in meditation, if you try very hard, if you look and plan for the next moment, then your meditation will really take off. It's a deluded ignorance, misinformed. Later on, you know, as you've been to many retreats, that if you just hang in this moment, then all the beauty, all the bliss, all the jhanas come to you. You don't need to send your mind out to seek them. And the jhanas arrive from a non-seeking, a still mind. So you can see the delusion there, looking in the wrong place, seeing the wrong thing. And that delusion is underlying these asavas, underlying the going out there into the world and doing things, thinking you can change it. So understanding that, you can see how delusion is actually what generates the asavas, the outflowings of the mind. And those outflowings of the mind can very often be craving. You go out because you want something, you want to get somewhere, you want to do something. If there's no craving, you wouldn't go out. Yes, yonisa manasikara, going back to the source of things, that goes inside. And going in the opposite direction, there's no moving out. So there can't be any karma formations there. You're not making anything, you're not doing anything, you're going in. Which is why you know when you meditate, you don't do anything. That's why you know all the time, one of the great things I was teaching those retreats is don't do anything. Just sit there and just allow things to happen. But you don't do it, you don't run the program. And you can see it just, that takes a lot of wisdom to do that. So it's from the end of delusion, the karma formation ceases. The karma formation ceases, rebirth consciousness ceases, another consciousness ceases. You can see the five sense consciousness of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching when you don't do anything. They just turn off. And with it, just all the problems with those five senses just disappear. And if you go deeper, and that still, even the sixth sense consciousness can cease as well. Temporarily in the jhana states, but it shows you what can happen when the whole thing ceases at the end of your journey through samsara. Dependent origination, and its opposite, dependent cessation. How to stop this whole process. The asavas is just one way of looking at that. But in particular here, you can see how the process works. Why the mind goes out. And what it does when it does go out. Does that make sense? Yeah. This is one of the causes. It's like taking the rug out from underneath where the asavas stand. So as that, they can't last much longer. It's terminating their life support system. So we're going to come to that in a few moments. Because having this monk having said that he does not just believe in this, he doesn't know this just because he's reasoned it out, it's because of preference, his preferred view. He says he knows this. And he was just said, you must be an arahat then. And this actually silently means no. And he's going to explain what he means in a few moments. How he can know this but not be fully enlightened. And this is actually, he's got that right view, which is a knowledge, not a belief, an experiential knowledge. He knows this, he's seen this. And another interesting point at the bottom here, which is I make a lot of, when many people pass this over. He says, after going through the 12 links, backwards and forwards, friend Musila, is it just through faith, preference, oral tradition, reason and reflection? Oral tradition would be the same as like belief in your sacred texts, which in those days were handed down as an oral tradition. Is it just be, you know, what you believe in your Tripitaka or whatever? Apart from reason and reflection, apart from acceptance of view after pondering it, does a venerable Mudsila have personal knowledge? Thus, Nibbana is the cessation of existence. Bhava Nirodha, the cessation of existence. And he says, yeah, it's apart from all those things, I know this, I see this. Nibbana is the cessation of existence. I know sometimes that people say, oh, it can't be. What is the cessation? What's the point of getting Nibbana if you can't be there to enjoy it anymore? And here is a very, very clear statement of what Nibbana is. The cessation of isness, of existence. I mean, it's a very, also a very powerful little statement there. Yeah. As far as you're concerned. I don't want to go, say some people. But obviously this was very well understood by many people, because it certainly was understood by the people asking this. They said, oh, you know that, you must be an arahat. But he kept silent. Before we continue, is there any other questions on this? Okay. Then the Venerable Narada, having asked Venerable Musila, then the Venerable Narada said to Venerable Sarvita, friend Sarvita, it would be good if I were asked that series of questions. Ask me that series of questions and I will answer you. Then let the Venerable Narada get to answer that series of questions, and I will ask the Venerable Narada that series of questions and let him answer me. And since Sarvita having asked Musila, then asked the same questions of Narada, and they were answered in exactly the same way. And so Sarvita said, oh, then the Venerable Narada is an arahat, one whose taints, asuras, are fully destroyed. And this is where we get the beautiful simile. Friend, though I have clearly seen as it really is with correct wisdom, Nibbana is the cessation of existence, I am not an arahat, one whose taints are destroyed. And he gives a simile. Suppose, friend, there was a well along a desert road, but it had neither a rope nor a bucket. Then a man would come along, oppressed and afflicted by the heat, tired, parched and thirsty. He would look down into the well, and the knowledge would occur to him, there is water. But he would not be able to make bodily contact with it. No bucket, couldn't get it out, he could see it, that's where the water is. So too, friend, though I have clearly seen as it really is with correct wisdom, Nibbana is the cessation of existence. I am not an arahat, one whose taints are destroyed. When this was said, the Venerable Ananda asked the Venerable Sarvita, when he speaks in such a way, friend, Sarvita, what would you say about the Venerable Narada? When he speaks in such a way, friend Ananda, I would not say anything about the Venerable Narada except what is good and favourable. This is the stream winner, just like someone who can see the water in the bottom of the well. They haven't got the rope and the bucket yet to draw it out. They can see Nibbana. They know what it is. Now they have to get hold of it. And that's the training from stream winning to full arahat. Stream winner knows what Nibbana is, but as yet, as they say, to touch it with their body, to realize it, to be one with it. Difference between seeing the water in the well and being able to take it out and drink it. Any comments or questions on that? Yes, John. Certainly, yeah. Correct. Correct. This is obvious. The Buddha taught Sila Samadhi Panya. He taught the Eightfold Path. He said to the four groups of people, to the monks, to the nuns, to the laymen and the laywomen, to all four. And there's many cases of people like Citta, who was later in other places said to be an anagami, a non-returner. And many of them occurred. Many of those people were found in the suttas. And all the anagamis, all the non-returners, all had facility with ease gaining the four jhanas. And the reason was there was nothing between them and the jhanas. Those hindrances which block you attaining those jhanas are no longer there. So it's as easy as walking through a door. So it's, I don't know whoever said that, but it's untenable according to what we know of history. And all the traditions will, the original traditions will say the same. The Buddha taught meditation to everybody, taught wisdom to everybody, taught the sila to everybody. I don't know where you heard that from, but it's not from me anyway. And there's a good case of Citta the householder, who not only sort of had great knowledge, but obviously experience of those jhanas. Ah, yes. Yes. In those days, the Buddhism obviously was incredibly strong under the guidance of a Buddha. And many, many people would do that. They would actually spend a lot of time practicing their meditation, remember at home, and would actually wear white. So white was a symbol of their purity. And it would mean they were keeping the eight precepts usually. The five precept lay followers, I think they would not usually wear... I think it was the eight precept ones would wear white as a symbol of their purity. And there's an interesting aside on that. You know that the word for white in the Latin language, from where English came from, is candid. That's the word for white. And so to be candid, be open, means actually be really being pure. And in particular, so I read, in ancient Rome, whenever there was an election for the Senate, the people would wear white if they were standing for election, which is where we get the word candidate from. Someone who wore white. And that was always a symbol of their purity and their goodness, which is why the candidates do not wear white these days. And they were elected always on their past performance, on their past reputation of virtue, not on their future promises. And so the word candidate meant someone wearing white as a symbol of their purity. And that was certainly from the Indian tradition of wearing white, if you were going to go to the temple, or especially if you were keeping eight precepts. Is there any other questions anyone has on that? Is it too deep for you about this? Bhava Nirodha is Nirvana. Somebody asked me that earlier. What is Nirvana? Cessation of existence. Do you want to cease? Okay, the next sutta, we've got number 69 there, but that was just there because I wanted to do number 70. So we'll just go over number 69, and the next sutta is number 70, which is quite another interesting sutta. Number 70,
Susima, quite a famous one as well. It's been quoted many times in many books. And it's an interesting sutta about, again, arahats and their nature. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was dwelling at Rajagaha in a bamboo grove in a squirrel sanctuary. And some of you were there not that long ago. No. One squirrel there, okay. There's some bamboo there anyway. Now on that occasion the Blessed One was honoured, respected, esteemed, venerated and revered. And he obtained robes, arms, food, lodgings and medicinal requisites. The Bhikkhu Sangha too was honoured, respected, esteemed, venerated and revered. And the Bhikkhus too obtained robes, arms, food, lodgings and medicinal requisites. But the wanderers of other sects were not so honoured, respected, esteemed, venerated and revered. And they did not obtain robes, arms, food, lodgings and medicinal requisites. Now on that occasion a wanderer Susima was residing in Rajagaha, along with a large company of wanderers. As well as the Jains, there were these other groups, which were just lumped together just as wanderers. In other words, people who would be searching for religious truths, very often under a particular teacher, and these wanderers were under Susima, and they would go from place to place, living very simply, very often debating with other wanderers to find out the truth of their existence. So then his company said to the wanderer Susima, "Come, friend Susima." Then his company said to the wanderer Susima, "Come, friend Susima, lead the holy life under the ascetic Gotama. Master his Dhamma and then teach it to us. We will master his Dhamma and preach it to the lay people. Thus we too will be honoured, respected, esteemed, venerated and revered. And we too will obtain robes, arms, food, lodgings and medicinal requisites." So in other words, if you go and learn what the Buddha's teaching and teach that to lay people, then we'll be rich as well. "All right, friends," the wanderer Susima replied. He then approached the Venerable Ananda and exchanged greetings with him. When they had concluded their greetings and cordial talk, he sat down to one side and said to him, "Friend Ananda, I wish to lead the holy life in this Dhamma and discipline. In other words, I want to become a monk." Then Venerable Ananda took the wanderer Susima and approached the Blessed One, the Buddha. He paid homage to the Buddha and then he sat down to one side and said to him, "Venerable Sir, this wanderer Susima says that he wishes to lead the holy life in this Dhamma and discipline. Well then, Ananda, give him the going forth." The wanderer then received the going forth and the higher ordination under the Buddha. So the going forth, you saw that just a week ago when we had the novice ordination, that's the going forth, and the full ordination is a bhikkhu. And we're going to do one of those ordinations on June the 6th, that's the higher ordination. Any problems so far? Okay, now on that occasion a number of monks had declared final knowledge in the presence of the Blessed One, saying, "We understand, destroyed is birth, the holy life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more for this state of being." That is the traditional way of claiming to be an arahat, fully enlightened. So then on that occasion, a number of monks had claimed to be arahats, fully enlightened monks. Then the Venerable Susima heard about this. So he approached those monks, exchanged greetings with them, and then sat down at one side and said to them, "Is it true that you Venerable Ones have declared final knowledge in the presence of the Blessed One, saying, 'We understand, destroyed is birth, the holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done, there is no more for this state of being'?" "Yes, friend," they answered. So Susima asks, "Then knowing and seeing thus, do you Venerable Ones wield the various kinds of spiritual power, such that having been one you become many, having been many you become one?" Which is what happened in the Matrix, apparently. And they got that from these suttas. That you appear and vanish. That you can go unhindered through a wall, through a rampart, through a mountain, as though through space. Like David Copperfield, only that was just tricks, this is real. You dive in and out of the earth as though it were water. You walk on water without sinking as though it were earth. And seated cross-legged, you travel in space like a bird. That's a levitation. And with your hand you touch and stroke the moon and sun, so powerful and mighty. and who exercise mastery with the body as far as the Brahma world? No friend. So he hasn't got that psychic power. Then knowing and seeing thus, do you, venerable ones, with the divine ear element which is purified and surpasses the human, hear both kinds of sounds, the divine and the human, those that are far as well as near? In other words, do you have that extrasensory perception? No friend. Actually, that's not such an uncommon one for meditators, actually, to have the divine ear element. There was one monk when I first went to Wat Pa Pong. I don't mind telling the story now. But he had a very deep meditation, and he actually could hear what was happening in the market, which was about 6 kilometres away. And very obviously he could understand the conversation, tell people what they were talking about. And he had that sort of ability. Then knowing and seeing thus, do you, venerable ones, understand the minds of other beings and persons, having compassed them with your own minds? In other words, can you telepathize? In particular, do you understand a mind with lust as a mind with lust? I'll just go through all those. This is just a standard way of knowing different types of mind. In other words, can you read other people's minds? And he said, no, friend. Then, knowing and seeing thus, do you, venerable ones, recollect your manifold past lives? That is, 100,000 many eons of world contraction, eons of world expansion, eons of world contraction expansion, thus. There I was so named, with such a clan, with such an appearance. Such was my food, such my experience of pleasure and pain, such my lifespan. Passing away from there, I was reborn elsewhere. And there too I was so named, of such a clan, with such an appearance. Such was my food, my experience of pleasure and pain, such my lifespan, and passing away from there I was reborn here. Do you thus recollect your manifold past lives, with their modes and details? No, friend. Then knowing and seeing thus, do you, venerable ones, with a divine eye which is purified and surpasses the human, see beings passing away and being reborn, inferior and superior, beautiful and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate, and thus understand how beings fare on in accordance with their karma thus. These beings who engage in misconduct of the body, speech and mind, who revile the noble ones and held wrong view, and undertook actions based on that wrong view, with the breakup of the body after death, they have been reborn in a state of misery in a bad destination, in the nether world, in hell. But these beings who engage in good conduct of body, speech and mind, who did not revile the noble ones, who held right view and undertook action based on right view, with the destruction of their body after death, they have been reborn in a good destination, in the heaven world. Thus, with the divine eye which is purified and surpasses the human, do you see beings passing away and being reborn, inferior and superior, beautiful and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate, and understand how beings fare on in accordance with their karma? No, friend. Then knowing and seeing thus, do you, venerable ones, dwell in those peaceful deliverances that transcend forms, the formless attainments, having touched them with the body? These are the immaterial attainments. Now, it's interesting here, it says touch with the body here. That actually means the same as in the sutra just before. It's a euphemism, but experience them for yourself. No, friend. Here now, venerable ones, this answer and the non-attainment of those states, how could this be, friends? In other words, how can you be an arahat and not have all these attainments? And they say, we are liberated by wisdom, friends Susima. I do not understand in detail, friends, the meaning of what has been stated in brief by the Venerable Ones. It would be good if the Venerable Ones would explain to me in such a way that I could understand in detail what has been stated in brief. Whether or not you understand, friends Susima, we are liberated by wisdom. And they went away. The point is here that Susima was under the impression that if you're an arahat, you have to have these attainments, these psychic powers, and even the immaterial attainments. But they said, no, they're liberated by wisdom. For those of you who know, let's see how much you know about these suttas. There's another type of attainment, as well as just being liberated by wisdom. What's the other description of the arahat? Close. It's a chaito vimutti, liberated by mind. The two. And what they really mean here, the liberated by mind, or liberated both ways, they sometimes call it, that means when you do have some of those attainments, in particular you have the
attainments of the immaterial jhanas. But not, you still, all the arahats have to have the attainment of the ordinary jhanas. I shouldn't call them ordinary, I call them that four jhanas.
Then the Venerable Susima rose from his seat and approached the Blessed One. Having approached, he paid homage to the Blessed One, sat down to one side, and reported to the Blessed One the entire conversation he had with those monks. The Blessed One said, "First, Susima, comes the knowledge of the stability of the Dhamma. Afterwards, knowledge of Dhamma. I do not understand in detail, Venerable Sir, the meaning of what was stated in brief by the Blessed One. It would be good if the Blessed One could explain to me in such a way that I could understand in detail what you have just said. Whether or not you understand, Susima, first comes knowledge of the stability of the Dhamma, afterwards knowledge of the Nibbana." Where's it going now? So, he just confounded Susima. Remember, Susima went into that, become a monk, because he wanted to learn these teachings and to misuse them so he could actually gain a lot of good support himself. And now the Buddha's deliberately confounded him to try and make him understand this is not such a simple thing. So now he goes into teaching to Susima on page 616. "What do you think, Susima, is form permanent or impermanent? In particular here, your body. Impermanent, Venerable Sir, is what is impermanent, suffering or happiness. Suffering, Venerable Sir, is what is impermanent, suffering and subject to change, fit to be regarded thus. This is mine. This I am. This is myself. No, Venerable Sir." And this is where we get, this is the standard interrogation technique of the Buddha. Is it impermanent? If it's impermanent, it's subject to suffering. Everything which you have to leave it alone, give it up, and so it's never really satisfying. This very changeability will cause suffering. In particular, you cannot say, "This is mine." If it was yours and you liked it, you'd be able to keep it going, have it for as long as you want, which you can't do. So because you know that its impermanence is beyond you, it's basically out of control, that means it is not mine. It's not right to regard it, "This is mine, this I am, this is myself." Now he goes with the other four of what's known as the five khandhas. His feeling, and feeling here is not the emotional feeling, it is the aspect of all sensory consciousness of pleasure, pain or in between, usually giving a different word depending upon which sense is experiencing that pleasure or which sense is appearing that experiencing that pain. So is that permanent or impermanent? Is the perception permanent or impermanent? This is the names and descriptions we give to our sensory experiences. Our volitional formations, especially will, permanent or impermanent? Is consciousness permanent or impermanent? Each one of these things, volitional formations, will, consciousness, the knower, they're all impermanent, Venerable Sir. Is what is impermanent suffering or happiness? Suffering, Venerable Sir. So is what is impermanent suffering and subject to change, fit to be regarded thus? This is mine, this I am, this is myself. No, Venerable Sir. Therefore, Susima, any kind of form whatsoever, form whatsoever, whether past, future or present, internal, which is your own bodily form, external, other people's forms or other things, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, all forms should be seen as it really is, with correct wisdom thus. This is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. So looking upon your body, your possessions, this isn't mine, this isn't me, this is not a self. Therefore, Susima, any kind of feeling whatsoever, whether past, future or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, all feeling, all pleasure and pain, should be seen as it really is, with correct wisdom thus. This is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. Any kind of perception whatsoever, whether past, future or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, all perception should be seen as it really is with correct. All perception should be seen as it really is with proper wisdom. This is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. Any kind of volitional formations, any kind of will whatsoever, whether past, future or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, all will should be seen as it really is with correct wisdom thus. This is not mine. This is I am not. This is not myself. You aren't the one in control. Any kind of consciousness whatsoever, whether past, future or present, this is knowing. Internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, all consciousness should be seen as it really is with correct wisdom thus. This is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. Seeing thus, Tsushima, the instructed noble disciple experiences revulsion towards form, towards feeling, towards perception, towards volitional formations, revulsion towards consciousness. What's the point of having these things? He experiences revulsion, he becomes dispassionate. Through dispassion, he is liberated. When it is liberated, there comes a knowledge it is liberated. They understand, destroyed is birth, the holy life has been lived, what has been done, had to be done, has been done, there is no more to this state of being. That's the traditional way of actually understanding the way to enlightenment through wisdom. And he goes on again with the dependent origination, because this also comes from the same collection of suttas. Do you see, Tsushima, with birth as a condition comes aging and death? Yes, Venerable Sir. Do you see with existence as a condition comes birth? Yes. And I just, with clinging as a condition, existence, with craving as a condition, clinging, with feeling as a condition, craving, with contact as a condition, feeling, with the six sense basis comes contact, from name and form comes the six sense basis. Name and form itself comes from consciousness. Consciousness is caused from volitional formations, and volitional formations are supported by ignorance. Yes, Venerable Sir. And do you see in the reverse form that with cessation of birth comes a cessation of aging and death? Yes. Do you see with the cessation of existence comes a cessation of birth? Cessation of clinging means a cessation of existence. The cessation of all these things all come from cessation of ignorance. Because cessation of ignorance makes the cessation of volitional formations. Yes, Venerable Sir. I'll pause there, because so far the Buddha has taken him just through the understanding of the physics of existence and the nature of non-self. Then, knowing and seeing thus, Tsushima, to you with the divine ear element, which is purified and surpasses the human, hear both kinds of sounds, the divine and the human, that are those that are far as well as near. No, Venerable Sir. Knowing and seeing thus, Tsushima, do you understand the minds of other beings? No, Venerable Sir. Do you recollect your manifold past lives? No, Venerable Sir. Knowing thus, do you with the divine eye, which is purified and surpasses the human, see beings passing away and being reborn, and understand how beings fare on in accordance with their Dharma? No, Venerable Sir. Then knowing and seeing thus, Tsushima, do you dwell in those immaterial attainments that transcend forms, the formless attainments, having touched them with the body? No, Venerable Sir. Hear now, Tsushima, this answer and the non-attainment of the states. How could this be, Tsushima? Tsushima gets the point. Then the Venerable Tsushima prostrated himself with his head at the Blessed One's feet and said, Venerable Sir, I have committed a transgression, and that I was so foolish, so confused, so inept, that I went forth as a thief of this Dharma, in such a well-expounded Dhamma and discipline as this. Venerable Sir, may the Blessed One pardon me for my transgression, seen as a transgression for the sake of future restraint. Surely, Tsushima, you have committed a transgression, that you are so foolish, so confused, so inept, that you went forth as a thief of this Dhamma, of the Dhamma and discipline. Suppose, Tsushima, they were to arrest a bandit, a criminal, and bring him before the king, saying, Sire, this man is a bandit, a criminal, impose on him whatever punishment you wish. And the king would say to them, come men, bind this man's arms tightly behind his back with a strong rope, shave his head, and lead him around from street to street and from square to square, beating a drum. Then take him out through the southern gate and to the south of the city, cut off his head. What do you think, Susima? Would that man experience pain and displeasure on that account? Yes, venerable sir. Although that man would experience pain and displeasure on that account, going forth as a thief of the Dhamma in such a well-expanded Dhamma discipline as this has results that are far more painful, far more bitter, and further it leads to the netherworld, the lower realms. But, since you see your transgression as a transgression and make amends for it in accordance with the Dhamma, we pardon you for it. For it is growth in the noble one's discipline when one sees one's transgression as a transgression, makes amends for it in accordance with the Dhamma, and undertakes future restraint. And at the end, we get just the usual Buddhist way of forgiveness. They say, even though the Buddha said, karmically, it's worse than actually having the karma from coming into being like a Buddhist monk just for the sake of your belly, and just for the sake of trying to steal the teachings and actually take them to somebody else. That's as bad as if you were a thief, and the karma is worse than if you were caught as a thief by a king and executed. He said, never mind. Anyone who confesses their offence, in other words, brings it out into the open, sees it as a transgression and makes amends for it and tries not to do it again, then it's always pardoned, because it is growth in the noble one's discipline. When you see your transgression and make amends for it in accordance with the Dhamma and undertake future restraint, that is all one needs to do. There is no punishment. Never was the idea of punishment in Buddhism. Seeing your transgression as a transgression, make amends for it and undertake future restraint. That's called growth. So, in that particular sutta, the Susima understood there that what it's like to actually understand the Dhamma. And sometimes people understand the Dhamma, they don't all have the psychic powers, but they still, some do, some don't. Any questions or comments about the sutta? Yes. Yeah. In a sense, they summarize it, but they overlap in many ways. So they do, in a sense, summarize everything, because we have birth and old age, sickness and death. That sort of describes sort of the human condition. But it doesn't actually say everything in existence, because it was the whole teaching, if you understand where it came from, the traditional story of Buddhism, that the Buddha saw the old age, sickness and death, and saw that no matter how comfortable, wealthy, rich, wise you are, that we all get old, get sick and die. And that was encapsulated in the three of the four visions which the Buddha had before he went forth, seeing the old man, the sick man and the dead man. And that was an important part, the underlying reason why he became a monk, to try and find an end to old age, sickness and death. Because realize whatever realm, whatever birth you get into, is always going to be old age, sickness and death. So in the investigation, how can we stop suffering? You say, well, no, we've got to stop old age, sickness and death, that's all. And it was a powerful insight of the Buddha to see it was birth is the cause. And it might seem sort of obvious. Yeah, when you're birthing, you get old, you're going to get sick, you're going to die. When you really sort of think about it and contemplate it deeply, what it really means that once you are born, you're liable to die in a tsunami, you're liable to get cancer, you're liable for all sorts of sicknesses and eventual deaths. It comes with being born. So no matter what happens in your early life or your middle life, you're always going to have to handle this old age, sickness and death business. And it just puts the what it might call just a stain on existence, a stain which can never be removed. So no matter how wise, sharp, how happy you are, you're going to end up in the same way. So because of that, the Buddha said, look, the whole thing is rotten.
You can't try and find some existence where there's a birth where you can actually avoid the suffering. So the only way to stop the suffering of existence is don't get born again. So all births into all realms have old age, sickness and death. Or at least death anyway. Fading away. So because of that, the problem sort of was moved from suffering, instead of stopping suffering, to stopping birth. And from the stopping birth, where does birth come from? Why do you get reborn? And that's where he started to see the forces which propel you from one life to another. First of all, seeing them as this process of existence, or rather existence itself, as a place to be reborn. And those places to be reborn being created just by the craving and not so much attachment, but the fuel, fueling rebirth. You may have heard me say in a talk a few weeks ago, why do people go to hell? And what actually is a hell realm? And so you create those hell realms. You make those hell realms. You design them according to your specifications. You create the heaven realms according to your specifications. You either create these realms, these are mind-made realms. Which is why, and I'm sure it's true, I remember reading the Quran many years ago when I was a student. No, before that, I was still at school. And I was wondering just about the descriptions of heaven in the Quran. Were always places with a lot of water. And very, very green, very cool. To me it sounded like England, the place I was trying to get away from. Because in England, the place you're trying to get away from, heaven was described as like these palm, sandy beaches. They were paradise. And that's where the Arabs lived. And you can see just your idea of heaven realm is what you actually create, what you think is heaven. And of course, having a Norwegian monk at our monastery, he really entertained us with the Norwegian idea of heaven, which is Valhalla. And according to their mythology, the heaven of the Vikings was this hall where, you know, you'd, after dying in battle, you know, for your tribe or whatever, then you'd reappear in this hall with this amazing feast and lots of alcohol. And you'd eat and you'd drink and then you'd have a fight. And having a fight was an important part of heaven in the Norse mythology. And everyone would fight and they would die. And then they'd suddenly wake up again and have a feast and start all over again. Eating, drinking, fighting. You know, what else can you want in life? Interesting, there was no sex involved in that thing. I'm not quite sure. But that's all it was. And if that's really what you want, that's what you'll create. And it may be that while they say those things, it's actually people could remember those realms of existence. So if you ever read about some of these, as you read the sutras, you read like people's descriptions of the heaven realms. Some of those huge palaces. What is that one where imagine where there's, was it 1,000 nymphs in every tower and 1,000 towers in this palace of Saka, the king of the gods? And he said, you know, what do you want that for? This is just the creation of the mind. What you'd actually create is your ideal heaven. So when you actually think about it, what is your heaven? Where would you like to be reborn? And your heaven will not be the same as his heaven or her heaven. Completely different. Some women would like a heaven there'd be no men. Some men would like a heaven there's only them and all women. So I don't know, but if that's what you want, and you've got the good karma, that is what you'll get. So it's a craving, leads to the fuel. You build up these things. So that's the Buddha actually saw actually how we create these worlds within worlds. It did, especially for hell, yeah. Because I could never understand that. The whole idea of like a hell seemed to be just such a sadistic thing. If anyone actually could make a hell, you know, especially the, you know, in Christianity, what compassionate, kind, superpower being could actually create such a place? Any compassionate God, if there was a place like that, destroy it straight away. Doesn't matter what a person's done, no one deserves to be tortured for eternity, no matter what you've done. It's against the human rights. It is, isn't it? What's that? You know what I'm talking about. But it's obvious that people create those hell realms. And this is deep subconscious. A psychologist would probably agree with me that you want to be punished. So you create the punishment, a suitable one for you. You create your own hell realms, both in this life and in the future life. And you can create the most amazing hell realms for yourself. Why do people do that? It's just their ignorance. You make those karma formations, that craving. You create those worlds. Boiled in oil or whatever else it is you want to be, to go into. So this is actually the dependent origination. Just how this origination, how these things are caused. And see, it's all basically, the main two causes of those things are the craving, fueled by ignorance, creating the fuel of more existence. So the Buddha's seeing that, how can we stop existence? To stop the suffering. There's also another part of that ignorance, is the thing, I don't want to stop the existence. And the craving to be. The very fact that, yeah, it's not all that good. I know we're going to get old and getting dying, but what the heck, it's better than anything, better than nothing. It will do. Yeah, I'm not ready to leave yet. Yeah, I know I'm going to get to have to go to school again, and wear nappies again, and go through this all over again, but I'm not ready to give it up yet. That's the delusion. That is the attachment. So when you can see that, really see that, understand there's no self in here, there's the suffering of a samsara. If you really see that, then you'll never be afraid by those teachings. You'll perceive that nibbana is the cessation of existence. Understand that dependent origination. You may be even able to claim yourself as a stream winner. You can see the water, the end of samsara, but you haven't drunk it yet. It's like you see the water in the bottom of the well, but you haven't dug it out yet. You understand, you see, but you haven't realized. Have I got the point across? Not really. Because once you are that, what is it called? Necessity is the mother of invention. So once you see the water, if you're very, very thirsty, you'll find a rope from somewhere. You'll find a bucket from somewhere. You'll find some way of getting that water out. Maybe if you're really that thirsty and you can't find a rope, you can't find a bucket, maybe you just jump in the water. Then you can touch that water with your body. At least you sort of don't die of thirst. But now you've got to find a way. The next problem is climbing out again. There is necessity as a mother of invention. And so when you see what the problem is, you'll find a solution. That's why they say, seeing the Dhamma, become a stream winner, at the very most 7 lifetimes, before you find the rope. Aha, yes, this knowledge of the stability of Dhamma, that's the attainment of stream winning. The understanding this knowledge, this Dhamma, doesn't exist just because a Buddha exists. This is like a natural law. Understanding it's like a law of physics, an unchanging law. It's always was, always will be, whether people discover it or they don't discover it, whether people know it or they don't know it, it's always their underlying existence. That understanding, like what they just said here about the dependence of origination, understanding about non-self, to see this is an underlying truth, which is always stable, always there. And to see that, you have to know it. So it's tantamount, the same as the experience of stream winning. Okay, any other questions people have on this deep Dhamma today? It's so quiet. I just wonder if I've gone too deep. Yeah. Yeah. Yami. Indeed, you just sometimes wonder about that, because there are people, they have many relationships. They get married not once and twice, three times. Say, like Prince Charles got married. So when he actually goes to heaven, if he ever gets there, you know, does he have Princess Di or does he have Camilla? Who's going to be his wife up there? That's going to be a difficult one. That's why the Christian church has a very tough time with like divorce and remarriage. Because afterwards you're supposed to go together up there and just wish more. They're kind of both up there, they have more arguments, and that can't be heaven. Imagine sort of when you die, does your cat go up there as well? If you really love your cat? Did you ask the cat, does the cat want to go up with you again? Doesn't it want to do something else in its life? Why should it always have to sort of follow what you want? So the point is, if you do go up to heaven, if you want your cat there, the cat's there, but it's not the real cat. It's the mind-made cat. If you've got a particular partner you really like, it's a mind-made partner. The real one goes off according to his karma. Sometimes you should ask that question, do cats and dogs go up to heaven? No soul. But yeah. Yeah. But does it, doesn't it get reborn as a human being or go somewhere else? When it gets to, when it actually get to heaven, what age do you want to be? Do you want to be sort of young and stupid? Or do you want to be like old and mellow? Whatever age you want to be. Yeah. Yeah. So open the bucket is Sila Samadhi Panya, the Eightfold Path. And draws the water out of the well. Is that okay? Yeah, okay. Yeah. Yeah. Correct.
But not necessarily immaterial
change. Correct, yeah. That's actually one of the, well, I say there's inner suttas, and it's mentioned here, two types of arahat. Those who've got just the, was it liberated through wisdom? Sometimes they call it liberated through non-clinging, through no fuel left, the fuel of delusion. So there's no, they understand, but they've got none of the psychic powers, they've got none of the deeper meditations, immaterial attainments. And there's the other type, who've got all the deep immaterial attainments and many psychic powers as well. Two types of arahats. They're both equal in their attainment, so never say one is more superior than the other. For they say that there's a few people have got a few of the side effects. But not everybody. The removal of the fetters is what makes you an arahat. It's just almost like the power which you bring to that, what, especially the amount of meditation you've been doing before the attainments. Those, and generally speaking, it's not always the case. If you've had a hard time getting there, you've done so much meditation, you get some of these side effects of the psychic powers at the same time. But those of you, those who have got a very, very strong wisdom element to them, they don't need to go so far. They can see Nibbana and they can actually realize it very quickly. Just like, you know, if you graduate from college, sometimes you have to do many side courses. But you know, sometimes people just focus and just go for the one course they want and they get there, but they don't have any so much width of their experience. I don't know if that makes sense, that simile. It's like somebody, for example, someone who goes to our monastery and they know the way, they always go on the same road, they get there very quickly. Someone else, they don't know the way, they get lost, they go down this way and that way, they eventually get to our monastery, and in the meantime they take a long time, they've got a lot of wisdom about the side streets and the back roads, because they've got lost very often. So they don't get to the goal so quickly, but they get a lot of wisdom on the way. That's right, yeah. This is the beginning of the dependent origination starting from delusion. But what causes delusion? What fuels delusion? Does anybody know the answer to that question? No? Close. This is one of the things which the Buddha said. You can't say that it's got a cause, but it's got a fuel. They call it a nutriment for delusion. And it's the five hindrances. The five hindrances of sensory desire, ill will, restlessness and worry, sloth and torpor, and doubt. The same five hindrances which stop you gaining into the jhanas are what fuels ignorance, keeps it going. The desire and ill will, again, they take you away from this moment. Another way of saying, you could actually say craving, because it's a more a refined way of looking at that craving. Desire means I want something else. Ill will means I don't want this. They both make you move from here. Restlessness and remorse, again, you can't stand this moment. You keep on going over here, going over there. You're never still in this moment to see what it's all about. Sloth and torpor, you may be still, but you're just too dull to see it. And doubt is also another type of restlessness, a verbal restlessness, where you don't give yourself enough time to see what's happening in front of you before you're questioning it. And then my simile is always, you make the assessment at the end of the experiment, not the beginning. You just gather data first of all. You don't doubt until the end. You gather data first of all. You don't say, is this true, is this not true? Shut up and just look. Later on you can actually start to ask those questions. So those five hindrances stop you seeing this moment. And because of that, not seeing what's really here, you just give the fuel to your old ways of thinking, to delusion. And when that five hindrances stop, when you go inside the moment, and you're not forced by desire, repelled by ill will, you're not so unstable with restlessness and remorse, you're clear from sloth and torpor, and you're still from doubt long enough to see. You can see things which you don't want to see. You can see things which you never expect. You can see the truth. So it's when these five hindrances disappear, the fuel for ignorance or delusion is removed, and little by little the penny drops. Correct, yeah. Correct, it's the five hindrances which fuels the belief in a self. Which means when those five hindrances are stopped, especially stopped in a long time in jhanas, your belief in a self, a doer and a knower, gets challenged. And the more times you enter those states, the more times you abandon the five hindrances, the more the delusion will be weakened and weakened and weakened, until one day it's so weak you just push it over, and delusion is destroyed. You become an arahant through the weakening of that process. Which is why the importance of meditation. Okay, yeah, and then, John. Correct, yes. Correct, this is. It's always the case that when one gets wisdom, one has more energy, one has peace, one has more power. And when the mind just goes out backwards and forwards, one wastes so much power of the mind. One wastes so much energy. And as you've heard me say many times before, the power of the energy is mental happiness. So the more deep one gets, the more one lets go, the more happiness one experiences, and the more energy and power. So it's as if the five hindrances, with all the wanting this, going there, not wanting that, running all over the place, or even the dullness, and all the doubting, that actually consumes energy, which could be better put into a better purpose. Yeah, I suppose so, yeah. It's the perceptions which one brings to this are very idiosyncratic, personal. But yeah, because the self confines you, it's like a prison of the self, which is a very famous and very well-deserved metaphor. And it's the, I might call the tyranny of the self, and always having to be somebody or do something. Because one of the aspects of the self is always has to do something to prove it exists. In the same way that, you know, as a doctor you might poke someone to see if they're alive. If they don't respond, you think, oh, they must be dead. The difference between a live person and a dead person is life does things. So because of that, then when you don't do anything, it's like a dying. Just the self feeds on doing things. On going out there in the world. It creates that arsenal of going out in the world and it feeds on it. So that the five hindrances actually feed that delusion, keep it going. Yeah. Correct, yeah. Well, this is bliss is what happens when. Okay. Yeah, it was. Sometimes in the letting go of the self there will always be some fear, because this is where the attachment to a sense of me, and thinking, I am going to die. And the reason why I pointed out that expression there, nibbana, is the cessation of existence. So some people that creates fear, as if like I'm destroying you, I'm taking over your soul, destroying your very essence. And if it does create fear there, why does it create fear? It's because there is an attachment. All fear comes from losing something which you think is yours, which you attach to, which you possess. You would never be afraid, you know, if somebody sort of steals my bowl or smashes up my hut. But if they smash up your car, you go, get out of here, that's mine. So the mind creates the attachment, which creates a fear of losing something. So when any fear comes up, it's always a sense of attachment has been taken away. But when you've lost all attachments, there can be no longer any fear. There's nothing to lose. There's nothing there anyway. And so the fearlessness, which is, comes after the attainments, that is always, it brings you a lot of bliss and happiness. A sense of freedom from a prison. An end of an affliction. Does that sort of answer your question? John, you had a question there? That certainly does weaken them, yes. So just the day-to-day awareness certainly weakens those hindrances. And it makes the path of meditation more easy. So it's not, these are things which support each other. The Buddha called it like sense restraint. And so one is restrained during the day not to allow sights, sounds, smells, tastes, touches, or even feeling, things in the mind to actually to create a fever in the mind. So you're very cool throughout the whole day. So mindful to those things, it means that when you start your meditation in the evening, the hindrances are pretty weakened, they haven't been strengthened all day. So it should be reasonably easy to get into quiet meditation. But the main place where one stops the hindrances is in the meditation. One weakens them through one's practice of virtue, and through one's practice of sense restraint, and you give them the final knockover in the meditation. Is that the question you asked? Okay, good. Okay. Questions? Okay, so thanks for listening to that sutta today. It's been a while since I've been teaching these suttas, so I'm not sure if I can remember just the stage where everyone else is at, but I hope you enjoyed that. That was a very deep sutta. I enjoyed those suttas myself, that's why I read them out. But the next sutta class will be in a couple of weeks' time, or I was just wondering whether to make it for 3 weeks' time, for the reason that in 2 weeks' time we're having our... No, it's a committee meeting, that's right, in 2 weeks' time, that's right, it'll be the 24th, I think. Today is the 10th, yeah, the 24th. We can do the next sutta class on the 24th. So has anyone got any suggestions for the sutta, for the next sutta class? I will be here for that one. We can actually use it from the Majjhima Nikaya, if those wish to use it from there. John has already got his hand up. So has Chris. So what was your suggestion for us, John? Okay. The cow herder. What number is that? Cow herder. Oh, is that, oh, that's the one with removes the ticks and removes the... No, okay. Yeah, it's alright. That's a short one. Maybe I have to do that. The long one. The long cow herder. What about you? Okay. Yeah, maybe do on a one-to-one. Okay, what numbers are those ones? The cow, that's about 20 or 30, isn't it? Yeah, it's one of the early ones, in the first 50. That's right, yes, I know this too. Should be in the family. You can find the index. Yes. It'll be in there somewhere in the first 50. But it's nice to know the numbers. So some, because there's many suttas that concerning with cows. Many cow suttas. I see the first 50, sure. 34? 33. It's easy one to remember, the two threes. And the other one is 34? Okay, 33 and 34 for 2 weeks' time. Okay, number 33 and 34? Two threes and 34. Okay, the age of Ainsley and Barbara, 33 and 34. Okay, so let's pay respects to Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, and then we can complete today. If you want to keep those sheets of those two suttas, please do so.
Arahaṃ Sammā Sambuddho Bhagavā Buddhaṃ Bhagavantaṃ Abhivādhayami Suvākkhato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammaṃ Namassāmi Suppatipanno Bhagavato Savakasangho Sanghaṃ Namāmi